Once again this morning over to Acts 18, Acts chapter number 18. And let's go down, let's start at verse 1. Acts 18, verse 1. And after these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth, and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome and came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought, for by their occupation they were tent makers. And he reasoned with them, and he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath, and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ. And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said unto them, Your blood be upon your own heads, I am clean, from henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard to the synagogue. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. Let's have a word of prayer. Our gracious God and Father, we thank you again that we can spend some time this morning in your word, and for the purpose of growing in understanding of your word and an appreciation of your grace in this dispensation of grace. So we do ask for light and wisdom now as we study together. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, so let's bring back to our frame of reference where we are in terms of our studies here in the Sunday school class. We have spent a number of weeks looking at where in the book of Acts the Apostle Paul wrote his various epistles. And what we've seen already, we've been able to identify where in the book of Acts he wrote the book of Galatians. And the last two times together, we were able to identify where in the book of Acts he wrote 1st and then 2nd Thessalonians. And if you'll recall, looked at verse chapter 18, verse 5. That's a significant statement when it says here, and when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ, and so on. And so we commented last week that based on the information over in 1 Thessalonians, that's when and where the Apostle Paul wrote 1 Thessalonians. Okay? Okay, so then let's just do it this way as well. Remember, we're kind of making reference to the timeline, the time chart. And so if you go in the book of Acts, what chapter in the book of Acts records, what is the initial chapter in the book of Acts where Saul's conversion is recorded? Acts chapter number 9. All right, so if you start there and you go all the way to Acts 28, which is the end of the book and so forth, what additional chapters in the book of Acts give us the additional details about Saul's conversion? Remember? No, it's Acts 22 and Acts 26. Okay, those are the three chapters in the book of Acts that give us the details about the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. All right? So where then in the book of Acts do we find the details about Paul's first apostolic journey? Where is it? That's right. So chapter 13 to 14 is Paul's first apostolic journey. Okay, that's his first apostolic journey. And Acts 15 is that very important trip that he makes, one of the very important trips he makes back to Jerusalem. And then, what chapters in Acts give us the second, the details about his second apostolic journey? Okay, 16 through what? There you go. So that's where we're at right now. Right? See, we're in Acts 18 right now. And what's interesting, if you'll notice Acts 18, look at Acts 18 and jump down to verse 18. So Acts 18:18 says this, and Paul after this tarried there yet a good while. So he's still at Corinth there, all right? And then took his leave of the brethren and sailed thence into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila, having shorn his head in Caesarea, for he had a vow. And he came to Ephesus and left them there. But he himself entered into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. And when they desired him to tarry a longer time with them, he consented not, but bade them farewell, saying, I must by all means keep this feast that cometh at Jerusalem, but I will return again unto you if God will. And he sailed from Ephesus. So he's going from Ephesus. Where is he going to, based upon what his statement at verse 21? He's going to go to Jerusalem. Everybody see that there? So now look at verse 21. And when he had landed at Caesarea, that's along the coast, and gone up and saluted the church, that's the Jewish believing church at Jerusalem. So that, and then it says, and he went down to Antioch. That ends his second apostolic journey. Okay, so it's 18 to 22 there. Okay, that ends his second apostolic journey. Everybody got that? So basically from chapter 16, chapter 17, and then to 18 verse 22, that covers his second apostolic journey. And again, one of the reasons that we're doing this is we're not going verse by verse through all these chapters and so forth. We're trying to get some. We're trying to make sure that we identify major events or references in the book of Acts that you see in his epistles, so that you can determine when he wrote the books, that type of thing. So, think about, for example, the book of 1 Corinthians. Does he mention the Corinthians, any of the Corinthians by name, in the book of 1 Corinthians? He does. So what is the absolute earliest he could have written the book of 1 and 2 Corinthians? Could he have written it before Acts 18? Yes, no. Could he have written the book of 1 Corinthians before Acts 18? He could not have. How come? Well, because he hadn't been there yet, for one reason. And then he mentions things in the book that happened while he was there. So again, the details help us to pinpoint where it was that he wrote these books. And we've determined that one of the reasons that it's helpful to know where he wrote these books is that way you know what he knew by what point in his ministry. Okay? So there are several real important details here in Acts 18, not just about Paul's apostolic journey and so forth, but that are going to help us pinpoint when he wrote the books of 1 and 2 Corinthians, and other books too, by the way. Okay, so let's go back to verse 1 then. This is when he comes to Corinth the very first time. Acts 18, verse 1. Okay, question for you. Where in the book of Acts do you find it that Luke tells us when Paul came to Corinth for the very first time? Where? What is it? Chapter 18, verse 1. So chapter 18, verse 1 tells us what? That Paul came to Corinth for the very first time. Okay, is that, am I repeating that? Some of y'all got that, right? Okay. Because this is, it's in, get that, okay? So if you think about Paul's second apostolic journey, he's been to some significant places, and some of them resulted in him writing books. In Acts 16, this is all review, by the way, okay? In Acts 16, where does he go? At Philippi, okay? In Acts 17, where does he go? Thessalonica. And where else? Berea. And where else? Athens. Remember that? And in chapter 18, where is he at now? He's at Corinth now. Okay? Is this going to help you get a better grasp of the book of Acts? It absolutely will. Okay? So these are significant places that he visited on his second apostolic journey. What's that? Yeah, that's down here, right? He goes Athens. No, Thessalonica is right there. Acts 17 is Thessalonica. Okay. All right. Let's pick up some more details now. So it says, and after these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome. And came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, he abode with them and wrought. For by their occupation, they were tent makers. Okay, this is the first time in the book of Acts that we are introduced to Aquila and Priscilla. What do we know about them?
They're Jews.
Excellent. They're Jews. What else? What's that? Exactly. They worked with their hands. They were tent makers. Good. What else do you know about them? What's that? They're from Italy. Why are they at Corinth? Yeah, because the government said, you get out or you die. How's that for a nice open type of society, right? All right? Yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know? Okay. What else, therefore, do you know? In other words, you know several things about Aquila and Priscilla that are going to help us, not just appreciating who they are. Paul actually says a lot of things about them in several of his documents that he writes. Okay? This is the first time not only that we were introduced to Aquila and Priscilla, this is the first time Paul met these folks. Now, if you think about Paul's ministry and the books that he writes and so forth, does Paul establish a pretty good relationship with these individuals? They become really close, very good friends, very work together in the ministry, that type of thing. Let me show you a couple of references. Go with me, if you would, over to the book of Romans. And on your way over, get 1 Corinthians 16. Look at this. You want to have 1 Corinthians 16, and you're going to have Romans 16. Look over to Romans 16. And now, he writes Romans to the Romans. Right? Is Rome in Macedonia or Achaia? It's a trick question. Okay. Neither one, is it? Right? Okay, good. Some of y'all got that. Right? You got to stay awake, right? She said neither one. Rome's not in either Macedonia or Achaia. Where's Rome? Over in Italy. Okay? So think about this. Look at Romans chapter 16. Verse 3. He says this. Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my helpers in Christ Jesus, who have for my life laid down their own necks, and to whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. Likewise, greet the church that is in their house. What do we know about Aquila and Priscilla from those verses? They've got a local assembly meeting in their house. What else? They're back in Italy. They're back in Rome. What's that? Promoting the gospel. That's right. They laid down their lives willing to be associated with the Apostle Paul and what Paul's teaching. Joe, go ahead. No, they weren't. No, not necessarily. They were not necessarily believers under the kingdom program. What you know from Acts and from this passage as well, from Acts you know that they were just Jews. When Luke records who they were in Acts, he doesn't indicate that they were part of the believing remnant of Israel. He just said that because Claudius commanded all Jews to leave Rome, they had to get out of Rome. That's correct. They're back in Rome now, believing what Paul's preaching. So think about that. That means they're under some potential danger here. Two ways. Claudia had commanded all Jews to leave Rome. And now they're back in Rome and preaching the gospel of God's grace. That's interesting. Go ahead, Henry.
It's interesting to note, I think, that Phoebe, who carried the letter from Corinth,
yes.
He carried the letter
to Rome. Yes. That, everybody hear what Henry said? If you look at verse 1, he mentions Phoebe here. He says, I commend unto you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church, which is at Caesarea, that ye receive her in the Lord as become a saint, and that ye assist her in whatsoever business she hath need of you, for she hath been a succor of many and of myself also. When Paul writes the book of Romans, he actually sends it to Rome with Phoebe. That's pretty amazing. That's pretty impressive, okay? So let me ask you a question. If in the book of Acts 18, that's the first time we're introduced to Aquila and Priscilla, right? That's the first time Paul meets Aquila and Priscilla. Since Paul mentions Aquila and Priscilla, and in a very personal, loving way, commending them, since he mentions them in the book of Romans, could Paul have written the book of Romans before Acts 18? He could not have. See how the information helps us narrow things down? Not only that, could he have written the book of Romans while he was at Corinth? Yes, no. Why would you say yes? Maybe I didn't ask the right question. Let me ask it again. My fault. Could he have written the book of Romans while he was at Corinth? Why no? She says, I don't know, but she says no. She got the right answer.
Did he write Romans while he was in Corinth?
No. Go ahead, Rich. I can't hear you. I'm sorry. Well, remember, think about Phoebe. I'm sorry, think about Priscilla and Aquila. Where is Priscilla and Aquila at the time Paul writes the book of Romans? He's back in Rome. Could Paul have written the book of Romans while he was at Corinth? Because that's where Phoebe and Priscilla are. He could not have written it while he was at Corinth. How come? Because they're with him. They're physically there with him at Corinth when he's at Corinth. So he could not have written the book of Romans while he was at Corinth. Because when he writes the book of Romans, Priscilla and Aquila are back in Rome and already have a ministry going. So those that didn't just get there. You see what I'm driving at? So he could not have written the book of Romans during his second apostolic journey. All right? Any questions on that? Does that make sense? I see some puzzle books out there. All right. Notice something else, therefore. This time, go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. So, another question. Could Paul have written 1 Corinthians while he was at Corinth? Could he have written 1 Corinthians while he was at Corinth? It would make no sense for him to have done so, because he would have been there right with them. Okay? Not only that, look over to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. I'm going to start at verse 5. He says, now I will come unto you. Well, that means he's not there. Everybody got that? He says, now I will come unto you when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia. You can see he's telling them his plans. So he's obviously not in Macedonia when he writes the book. It may be that I will abide, yea, in winter with you, that ye may bring me on my journey whithersoever I go. For I will not see you now, by the way, but I will, but I trust to tarry a while with you, if the Lord permit. But I will tarry where? So where is he when he writes 1 Corinthians? He's at Ephesus. So he's in Asia, and specifically at Ephesus. Keep reading. He says, for a great door and effectual is open unto me, and there are many adversaries. Okay. Jump ahead then, if you would, to verse 19. He says, the churches of Asia, so there are several groups that are going in Asia, such as Ephesus. Okay. He says, the churches of Asia salute you. Aquila and Priscilla salute you much in the Lord with the church that is in their house. Now, wait a minute. Where's Aquila and Priscilla when Paul writes the book of 1 Corinthians? They're in Asia. They're with Paul. And they got a church in there. Everywhere these people go, they learn the grace message. Now they're getting the message out to people. That's interesting. Once they learn the grace message from the Apostle Paul, everywhere they go back. They travel with Paul. They go to Asia, in Ephesus. They start a little group there. They go back to Rome. They start a group over there. Everywhere these people go, they're starting little groups of believers. Isn't that fascinating? But they're with the Apostle Paul when Paul's writing this book, and he's writing it from Ephesus, 1 Corinthians. All right? So let's do this then. Go back with me over to Acts 18. Where in the book of Acts is it that the Apostle Paul goes to Ephesus for the very first time? In the book of Acts. In connection with Aquila and Priscilla being with him. Watch this. Look at Acts 18. Acts 18, verse 18. It says this. And Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren, and sailed thence into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. See, now they accompany Paul, right? So they leave Corinth and begin to travel with Paul. And they go down to Caesarea. Look at verse 19. And he came where? And left them there. So they stay in Ephesus for a little while. Paul's there for a very short period of time, but then he leaves because he wants to go to Jerusalem. So what I'm driving at is that you can see how some of these details fit together, not just with the book, the details in Acts, but the details in the epistles that he writes. And it helps you narrow down the window as to when he wrote the books. He could not have written 1 Corinthians prior to Acts 18, verse 19. He could not have written it prior to that because of information. He doesn't write it right there, by the way. He doesn't write it till Acts 19. But I'm just saying, it helps you understand that he could not have written it before this point. All right? Now, let's get some other details about the church at Corinth. Notice, if you'll go back with me, so you're at Acts 18, and this time I'm going to go to verse 6. 18:6. It says, and when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he's in the synagogue at this point, right? He shook his raiment and said unto them, your blood be upon your own heads, for I am clean, from henceforth I will go to the Gentiles. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard to the synagogue. Okay, that last statement, what does that mean? His house joined hard to the synagogue. Yes, like a condominium, they have a joint wall, right? So this guy, wait, what's that? Well, I mean, to get up and go to synagogue on the Sabbath, he just had to walk out his front door, walk in the back door, and he's there. This guy was an Old Testament Bible-believing Jew. He would go to the synagogue. Paul shows up in the synagogue. And what was Paul's pattern when he went to the synagogue? Remember, we saw it very clearly in Acts 17. Go back to Acts 17. That's right. Go back to Acts 17, you'll see Paul's pattern. Whenever he went to the synagogue, what his pattern was. Go back to Acts 17, verse 3. I'll start at verse 2. It says, and Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures. That would be the Old Testament. And it says, opening and alleging. So he had two basic things that he said. He opened and alleged this. Number one is this, that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead. That's the first proposal he's making. When it says Christ, he's just talking about the title. Whoever the Messiah was, the Old Testament said Christ was going to suffer and rise from the dead. That's his first proposal he makes to his audience. Yes, and we go to all those verses that we looked at, demonstrating that that is what the Old Testament said Messiah would do. Messiah would come. He would suffer, and he'd be the first to rise from the dead. So then, having established that from their Old Testament, now what's the second thing he does? Look at what it says there. And that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ. That was his pattern. He would go to their Old Testament scriptures. He would quote those Old Testament scriptures. He'd say, look at them, turn at them, let's talk about them, and so forth. You'll see that your Old Testament, his Old Testament too, because he was a Jew, right? Very clearly indicated that Christ was going to suffer and rise again from the dead. And having demonstrated that, then he would say, the Jesus that I'm preaching to you is the Christ. And we looked at a number of verses that the Apostle Paul would likely have used to absolutely demonstrate that point. Okay? So when you go back over to chapter 18 now, he's following the same pattern in the synagogue. And this man, Justus, what happens to him? Look, it's amazing. Look at verse 7 again, 18:7. It says, and he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that joined hard to the synagogue. Well, why do they go in this man's house? This guy obviously becomes a believer. See, this is what the Apostle Paul says. Man, this makes total sense. I can see how this all fits together. So the guy becomes a believer. Not only that, look at the next verse. And Crispus. Well, who's he? Look at the next statement. He's the chief ruler of the synagogue. Believed on the Lord with all his house. And many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. Go ahead. Well, because at this time, Paul was still baptizing. Yeah, this is, and that's one of the questions that we've talked about. Why does Paul, in his early ministry, do some things that later on he stops doing? That's right. He's getting information as he proceeds. Yeah. So you can see very early on, he's obviously baptizing. Okay? Now watch this. Excuse me, watch this. Hold this passage here, and I'm going to have you go to 1 Corinthians. Go to 1 Corinthians, chapter number 1. Look over to 1 Corinthians, chapter number 1. look at some people he mentions. In 1 Corinthians, chapter number 1, I'm going to start at verse 14. He says, I thank God that I baptized none of you but who? Now see the Crispus there? And go back to Acts chapter number 18, verse 8. And there he is. Who is Crispus? And not just that, he was the chief ruler of the synagogue. That guy gets converted. Okay, it was Acts 18:8 and 1 Corinthians 1:14. Yeah, he's stirring at the hornet's nest, isn't he? He's the chief ruler and he gets converted. Yes. Yes, yeah. That's exactly what would happen. Think about this. So on one side of the building, again, it's a building that has a joint wall, a common wall. So on the one side of the building is where the synagogue, the Jews are meeting in the synagogue. And all of a sudden, Justus, his own house, becomes a local assembly for the believers now. So people are moving from this apartment to this apartment, if I can say it that way. You betcha. This is a shock through that synagogue there. When you lose the chief ruler of your synagogue through this information Paul's preaching. So Justus, think about this. I mean, you don't know this for sure. But if Justus's house joined hard to the synagogue, he probably had some influence over the synagogue. Right? Who knows? Maybe they were written from him. Or maybe he was written from them. I don't know. But the point is, there's some kind of connection here. Well, Justus gets converted. And then Crispus and his whole house get converted. So where are they going to meet now? Justus says, come to my place. It's a short distance. You won't have to pay any gas or you feed your mule or nothing like that. Just walk right next door. And they start meeting over there. Go ahead. Well, for the believers, of course, he's preaching more than just that. Yes. Yes. Yeah, the question that John is asking is that initially what Paul would do is he would seek to teach them that Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ. Then once he would teach them that, of course, he would teach them the gospel of their salvation. That's correct. Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, watch something else. Go back to Acts 18. Go back to Acts 18. Let's keep reading here. So you can see at 18:8, Crispus gets converted. 18 verse 9, the Lord actually appears to the Apostle Paul in a vision, and he says this. He says, I'm at verse 9, he says, "Be not afraid, but speak and hold not thy peace, for I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee, for I have much people in the city." And he continued there how long? Now, Mark, make sure that you always remember that Paul was at Corinth for a year and a half. But, watch this. Look at verse 18. It says, "And after this he tarried there yet how long?" Okay, so you're not told how long a good while is, but presumably it's more than a week or so. So what I'm saying is that Paul was at Corinth, we say at least a year and a half, plus a good while, whatever that is. So that's why I said Paul was probably at Corinth maybe two and a half, maybe three years. So keep that in mind as you kind of go forward about this. Watch what happens now. Look at verse 12 now. "And when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia, the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul." So those would be the unbelieving Jews, right? "And brought him to the judgment seat, saying, 'This fellow persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law.' And when Paul..." Isn't that interesting how you have a government law that tells you how you have to worship God? You guys are becoming more familiar with that concept, aren't you? Okay. It says, "When Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said unto the Jews, 'If it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, O you Jews, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names and of your law, look ye to it, for I will be no judge of this matter.' And he drave them from the judgment seat." Now, pay close attention here. "Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes," who's he now? He's the chief ruler of the synagogue. Well, wait a minute, I thought Crispus was. He was, and then what happened? They had to vote someone else in. We got to find someone else to lead us. So Sosthenes becomes the chief ruler of the synagogue. And the poor guy gets beat up here. You can see at verse 17. "Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogues, and beat him before the judgment seat." Think about that. What do we know about Sosthenes? He's a Jew. He was the chief ruler of the synagogues. What was he doing at the judgment seat? What's that? He's getting beat up by the Greeks for wasting Gallio's time. What was he doing at the judgment seat? He was leading the rebellion against Paul. If he's the chief ruler of the synagogue, and the Jews with one accord made insurrection against Paul, this guy's the leader that took and charged Paul. You understand that? It is. Interesting parallel, isn't it? Okay. So, he's not here by accident. He's not just a Jew that happens to be walking by. The Jews were making insurrection against Paul and what he was preaching. They take it to the authorities, hoping the authorities can shut him down. And Sosthenes, the guy that's right up there at the front. Go ahead, Scott. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear it. But now do you see why he's being beaten? It's the Greeks, it's the Gentiles who are beating him. Not because the Gentiles are supporting Paul. They're just annoyed by the Jews that are creating this insurrection, is what's happening here. Okay? Well, now watch this. Go back to 1 Corinthians chapter number 1. And look at that very first verse. 1 Corinthians 1:1. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 1. What does it say there? Paul called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God, and guess who? This guy became a believer. Do you see how significant that is? How powerful that is? This guy, he was the replacement chief ruler of the synagogue when Crispus got converted. Paul's preaching there a year and a half. These unsaved Jews are tired of the influence and the conversions that are happening. In other words, their offerings are going down. Can I say it that way? All right. He keeps losing people to just the house where justice is meeting with the believers. Crispus gets converted. Crispus' whole house. A lot of other Jews get converted and so forth. So now the Jews, the unbelieving Jews, have to figure out some way to try to shut this guy down. Shut Paul down. They think they can get the government to do it. They go and make insurrection to Gallio, thinking that Gallio will be sympathetic to their charge. When Gallio refuses to even hear them and so forth, well, the Gentiles, unbelieving Gentiles, now beat Sosthenes because he's the guy that was leading the rebellion. And then lo and behold, he gets converted. That tells you something about what Paul was preaching, doesn't it? Yeah. In more ways than one, right? You know? But it was absolutely having an impact on the Jews in that territory, and the Gentiles too. When you read the book of 1 Corinthians, you see there's a huge makeup, both Jews and Gentiles, in that local assembly. You had a bunch of Jews that were getting converted because they were believing what Paul was preaching. You had a bunch of Gentiles that were also getting converted because they were believing what the Apostle Paul was preaching. Isn't that amazing? So by reading details like this, not only is it pretty exciting to see the power of the gospel when someone will let it get into their heart, but it also helps pinpoint when and where Paul wrote the book. So in other words, if he mentions in the book of 1 Corinthians, he mentions Crispus, he mentions Sosthenes as a brother. So he could not have written 1 Corinthians before the conversion of Sosthenes. He mentions Aquila and Priscilla with him at Ephesus. Well, then he could not have written it before that point. All right, he writes it later on and so forth. All right, so let's keep reading down here. Watch what happens now. So look at verse 17 where they beat him and so forth. Verse 18 says this, "And Paul, after this, tarried there yet a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren, and sailed thence into Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila, having shorn his head in Caesarea, for he had a vow." Now again, you can see the Apostle Paul doing some things here early in his ministry that he's not doing later on. One is the issue of baptism, two is this issue of the vow. That's going to come again even towards the end of his third apostolic journey, the issue of a vow. Let's talk about that, because it does create some problems for some individuals, and that is, why is Paul doing this vow? Go ahead. Who's he making the vow to? Good question. So, is he making this vow because he thinks he has to make it in order to be right in the eyes of God? No. He's already written the book of Galatians by this point, so he knows that a man is justified not by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ. So he's not doing this vow in relationship to God. Why is he doing this vow? Go ahead. Okay, you're on the right track, but to who? Yes. If you look over with me to 1 Corinthians, look at what he says over here at 1 Corinthians 9. You'll see the principle of Paul's thinking. Chapter 9, 1 Corinthians 9. And you'll get a pretty good idea of his thinking here. I'm going to start at verse 19. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19 says this. He says, "For though I be free from all men..." 1 Corinthians 9, 19. For though I be free from all men, yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jew. That's why he did it. So that he's not doing it in a sense of thinking that he's got to have that vow in order to be right in the eyes of God, or that he needs to have that vow in order to stay saved or be blessed. He's doing it because he realizes that they all know he's a Jew. And he's seeking to reach them. But in other words, he doesn't want to have automatic doors closed, if possible. He's trying to at least make it so that he himself is not the reason for the immediate rejection of what he's saying. Tom, go ahead. That's correct. Yep. Yeah, he's not violating the grace he's preaching. He's not violating the law and so forth. He's simply trying to make it so that he's not offensive to the unbelieving Jews. The message might be, and it was, but he doesn't want to be the cause of them just immediately rejecting what he's preaching. Okay, I saw another hand. Scott, go ahead. Beth? Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yes. That is his thinking. Yes, that's exactly what he says in this same context. Look at verse 20 there. He says, "And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jew. To them that are under the law, as under the law, that I might gain them that are under the law." So he's talking about those the Jews under the law there. "To them that are without law, as without law," being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, "that I might gain them that are without law. To the weak became I as weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means gain some," save some. See that there? That's the principle. Let's talk about this for a few minutes. Because sometimes people will use this passage and say, well, okay, so even though water baptism, this is just one example, even though water baptism is not appropriate to the dispensation of grace, we should still baptize so that we're not a stumbling stone. We know better, but so as not to turn people away from the message, let's just go ahead and practice water baptism. Does that fit this context? It doesn't at all fit the context. It's not the same thing. When the Apostle Paul says, look at how he says it. Look back at verse 21. "To them that are without law, as without law." What does that mean? Who was without law? So then he says, "I was without law." Does that mean he went around robbing banks and killing people? No. Is it as he went out to reach the Gentiles, he didn't approach them from the standpoint of seeking to make them become Jews under the law. He sought to relate to them where they were at, not by violating the law. See that there? So the concept, the idea that, well, we know that water baptism is not appropriate to the dispensation of grace, but so as not to be a stumbling stone, let's go ahead and practice it. No, then you'd be violating what the truth of God's Word says. When he says, hold on just a minute. When he says, look back at verse 20, he says, "And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law," who would that be? That's the Jews. "As under the law." What does that mean? He absolutely respected the law. And he did, by the way. Okay? He respected the law. He respected the Old Testament. He respected the customs, the things like that. Yes, exactly. And what's his goal? His goal is to try to gain some. See that? You're looking for a common denominator to be able to share the gospel with someone. All of us come from different backgrounds. You guys know my background, particular religious denomination and so forth. So because of my background, I can understand how someone in that background would think about approaching God, think about forgiveness of sins, think about the mediator, things like that. So, it's not that I'm better equipped than anybody else, it's just that I can kind of relate to that person, therefore I know I'll try to approach it this way, as compared to something different. What's that? Yeah. So whatever your background is, you can relate to that person in trying to reach that person. Okay? Matt, you had a question or a comment? What's that? Yeah, there's some Old Testament things about a vow. Yeah, about a vow. If you make a vow, it's like in Leviticus, that type of thing. Yeah. What's that? Yes. Yeah, so in other words, he wasn't under the law in the sense of thinking it was going to maintain his relationship to God. He was not violating the law. Because, you know, if he came in, if he came into the synagogue and just the first sentence out of his mouth was, hey, you guys are all wrong, the law has been abolished, it's done away, no one's going to listen to him. Instead, what did he do? He went to their Old Testament scriptures, proved that Christ, the Messiah, had to suffer and rise from the dead, and then this Jesus whom I'm preaching to you is Christ. Once he gets them to see and appreciate that, now he can teach them additional information. Okay? Go ahead, Henry.
Question on how do you square that with his actions in Galatians 2 when he said that Galatians 2 verse 4 says and that because of false brethren unaware brought into King and privilege to fight out our liberty which we have in Christ Jesus that they might bring us into bondage to whom we gave play by subjection no.
Yeah, okay, let me repeat the question. The question is, doesn't it seem therefore to contradict Paul's statement in Galatians 2:4 when he was not willing to allow Titus to be circumcised and yet over in Acts 18 he himself took a vow? What's the difference between Titus and Paul? Titus was a Gentile, Paul was a Jew. That's why you can see that verse 3 it says, but neither Titus, who was with me, being a Greek, was compelled to be circumcised. That's the difference right there. Okay? Titus was a Gentile, not a Jew. Okay? But Jamie was next, and then Marty. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. That right there. Yeah. So in other words, is it... We know we're not under the law but under grace, right?
Yes.
But does that mean it's okay to break the law? Not at all. Okay? In fact, if you live under grace, go with me over to the book of Romans chapter number 8 here. The way that you do fulfill the law in the dispensation of grace is by living under grace. That's interesting, isn't it? Look over to Romans 8. Look over to Romans 8 at verse 3. 8:3 says this, for what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh. What is it the law cannot do? It can't justify you. It can't save you. That's not its job. Okay? It says, for what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh and for sin, condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled. Notice the next word there. See, not by us, but in us who do what? But after the Spirit. When we walk after the Spirit, by default, you're fulfilling the law, but not because you're under it. For example, how many of y'all went out and robbed a bank this morning? Ken's hand went out halfway. Okay. He got there, but Dan stopped him and said, no, we got to go to church. We'll do it tomorrow, you know. Yeah, I forgot it was Sunday. Yeah, yeah. We have to do that after church, yeah. Dan, did you really say that? Man. Anyway. So think about this. How come you didn't rob a bank this week? How come you didn't... Yeah. You obeyed the law, But not because you woke up every morning saying, I better obey the law, or I'm going to lose my salvation. You obey the law because you live under grace. And grace teaches you to do what's right in God's eyes. Living under grace is a way higher standard than living under the law. It takes a way higher power. Is that even proper English? A greater power to live under grace. When you live under grace, by default, you don't violate the law. That's one of the things the law does. The law does its job. It's in Romans 3. Look over to Romans 3 there. Yeah. It's the government's job to take the money. That's why you didn't rob the bank, Joe says. Look over to Romans 3, verse 31. He says, Romans 3, 31 says this, Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid, yea, we establish the law. That particular context, what establishes the law is to demonstrate that you can't be saved by it. Therefore, if you're going to be saved, there has to be a totally different system by which you're going to get saved, which is grace. Okay. All right, listen, we're out of time, but don't get confused about that thing when Paul took that vow. You understand why he did it. He's seeking to make sure that he's not the reason for the offense, because the message is going to be offensive by itself. He just wants to make sure that he's not the one that's causing the offense. Okay? Okay, we'll take a break. We'll start here in a little bit.